parent relationship lecture series. We hope that there will be many more in the future. These lectures are geared for us to learn about the value of the relationship between parent and child, and we are very fortunate to begin our CPR lectures with two outstanding individuals. It is my pleasure to introduce our speakers tonight because they are my colleagues, but more importantly, they're my Rebbeim in life, who I've learned what Torah Chaim is all about. Dr. Ben Sarufkin has smicha from the Ne'er Yisrael Rabbinical College in Baltimore, Maryland, and he received his doctorate in clinical psychology from Yeshiva University in New York. Dr. Sarufkin lived in Israel for 7 years, where he served as a psychologist at the Youth Aliyah Psychology Clinic. He also served as psychologist in the Israel Defense Forces as part of his Army Reserve duties. He has published articles in professional journals such as Clinical Psychology Review, Psychotherapy, and Psychotherapy Bulletin, and in Jewish periodicals such as The Jewish Observer, The Jewish Parent Connection, and Parent to Parent Magazine. Since 1985, he has maintained a private practice in psychotherapy in Brooklyn, New York, and tonight he's going to be speaking about you can't be too rich, too happy, or too perfect, the idea of perfectionism.
I hope all the parents realize that the title on the handout was a tongue-in-cheek, you know, you could be too perfect. Because, you know, you can't be too rich or too something and too perfect. Well, I guess the point here is that you could be too perfect, and we'll explain why. I work a lot with adolescents, and one of the big problems today in the community is acting out adolescents. But my topic today is not on that subject, because I think what I'm going to be talking about today is the flip side of that problem. You have youngsters who, because of their frustrations and problems, act out, rebel, and you have kids who, because they're frustrated and unhappy with themselves, they try to become perfect as a compensation for their negative feelings about themselves. Now, one thing I found, one of the reasons I'm happy to speak to parents of children in younger grades, because I find working with these youngsters, it's clear to me that many of these problems are highly preventable. And I think there are things we can do when they're younger to avoid many of these problems, and I'd like to speak about some of those things. The type of problems that I see are the results of stress. Now, when a youngster feels that they're only worthwhile if they do things perfectly. As you know, you speak to teachers. I've heard it more often in girls' schools, but it happens by the boys too. But in the girl high schools, if a teacher will give a girl a 95, she won't be surprised if the girl bursts out crying. Hysterics, right? It's a tragic thing that she only got a 95. Feeling that you have to get a 98 or above is an incredible stressful thing because, you know, just taking a test is stressful enough. I mean, when I was in school, I was worried if I was going to fail or pass. But, you know, on the days if I actually studied and listened in class, I was reasonably confident that I at least passed. And I don't know why my parents never were satisfied with just passing, but to me that sounded pretty good, at least until I got into college. You know, today in high school, the girls think it's the biggest tragedy. So, of course, there's an incredible amount of stress. Kids study day and night. I don't know if it's in all communities and neighborhoods, but where I come from, it's like the studying goes on like incredible. And it causes a distortion of values. I once asked the principal of the school, I said, I'm going to ask you, in your school, if there was a girl who was having a test the next day, and she's a good student, she listens to class, she studies, she does her homework, and without studying, she would easily get an 85. Now, her grandparents are visiting from Israel, and they're only going to be here in town for one day. Right? Now, you think the girl's going to spend time with her grandparents, or is she going to be studying for the test to make sure she gets a 95? So most of them would be studying for the test. Is that what we teach them? Is that so important to get a 95 instead of an 85? Many of the kids that I see, and I have many patients who come with psychogenic illnesses, you know, illnesses caused by stress. Kids who come with chronic headaches. These are like 16, 17-year-old kids. Chronic headaches, backaches, stomach aches, have gone through 1,000 tests, MRIs, and everything else, and finally they conclude this is coming from stress. I have kids these kids were often the top of the class, the kids from the top 2% of the class, and they end up being dysfunctional. I worked with one recently, saw a kid who was the top of his class, who was home for 5 months because he couldn't function anymore. And he was running from one doctor to another until they concluded that it was caused by his emotions, not by anything physical, although the physical pain was real. And now I see this, as I said, as the flip side of acting out. The kid is dealing with frustration by trying to make himself so perfect that nobody can have any complaints about it. Now, this, when a kid has to be perfect in order to be okay with himself, that's indicative that the kid's default setting about himself, for those who are familiar with computers, right, has a standard way of looking at himself, that he's worthless, that he's no good, he's bad, and therefore the only way he can redeem himself is by being perfect. People, in recent years, there have been many studies about this issue of perfectionism, and it's been linked to anxiety, to depression, and even to teen suicide, or even suicide among older people. There was a recent article in the American Psychologist where somebody did research on three well-known people who committed suicide. One of them was Vince Foster, who was shortly after his suicide, and concluded that these three people were perfectionists, were never satisfied with themselves, were so driven that no matter how, you know, Vince Foster was obviously in the world's eyes, was very successful, had a very important position, and was very successful as a lawyer. But evidence from people who knew him, biographies and, you know, stories in the press, that he himself was never satisfied with his success. Now, the question is, how can you be too perfect? You know, being good is good, and being better is better, and being perfect is perfect. I mean, like, how could there be anything wrong with that? But I want to explain that there's a distinction. You know, we're all taught to strive and try to be better, and, you know, it's wonderful. But there's a distinction between striving for excellence and the quest for perfection. If a person is reasonably happy with themselves and reasonably aware of their accomplishments, and there's certain things that you're very good at or you enjoy, then you'll get better at it. I've never seen that one has to pressure a kid who enjoys basketball to play basketball. They go out there, they have a good time, although perfectionists go crazy about basketball too, because there might be somebody else on the court who plays better than that. But, you know, a kid who's not a perfectionist, if he enjoys basketball, he'll get better and better at it because he enjoys it, and he'll keep on practicing and doing better. By a perfectionist, and therefore, if a kid who is striving for excellence has a game, and it was good, but not his best game, and there was somebody on the court who played better than him, it won't be devastating. He'll be reasonably satisfied, although may have hoped to have done better, but would be reasonably satisfied. A perfectionist would experience such a game as an incredible failure, as a devastating, as a catastrophe. There was a kid who told me this morning that when he plays basketball and there's even one kid on the court, he's a pretty good basketball player, there's one kid on the court who's playing better than him, he says he's devastated. When he learns that somebody said a thought in Gemara that he didn't think of, he's devastated, even though he's one of the best kids in the class. The underlying motivation of why people do things are very different by the healthy person who's striving for excellence and the one who needs to be perfect. The one who needs to be perfect, what drives him to do better and better is a fear of failure. Because failure, which he defines very broadly, is devastating. And that's what drives him to continue to do better. The healthy person who is striving for excellence is driven by an enjoyment or a wish for success. Somebody actually made a study of athletes comparing those at the very top and those who are just right below them, and found the difference is the ones who are at the top are usually the ones who can sustain that level are driven by a wish to succeed. They're happy with their success. But they're not so driven. The other ones who are right below them are driven by a fear of failure. And they suffer much more stress, and therefore they usually end up dropping down from their level. Now, what's interestingly enough, as I indicated, when a person is a perfectionist, now, the reason why it's so appealing to be a perfectionist, because for a while it works. One of my colleagues once said, you can't get through graduate school without being a perfectionist. But that may or may not be true, but certainly for a while it looks good, because if you drive yourself and you feel that you have to do things perfectly, so then you'll probably, at least for a while, achieve a lot, because you'll drive yourself and you'll never be satisfied and you want to do more and more. But eventually the pressure catches up with you, because the anxiety before anything you do is so great. There's a fellow named David Burns who's by now written about 25 books. The first book he wrote about was something about perfection. I forget the name. But what happened was when he wrote this book, he writes in his first book that it took him 10 years to write the first book because he was a perfectionist. He kept on procrastinating. It caused him so much stress to sit down and write because it had to be done perfectly that he'd keep on putting it off, and then he'd have to rewrite it and then rewrite it again. It, he says once he cured himself of his need to be perfect, so he's been knocking off like every 6 months he writes another book. Okay, now, when a person feels this tremendous pressure to do things perfectly, when the person is not able to live up to these unreasonable standards, so not surprising, the person feels depressed. And it often leads to two types of clinical problems that we often see. You have people who develop obsessive-compulsive disorder. As you know, those are people who have to do everything, you know, have to do things 20 times because it's not exactly right, who constantly worry about doing things right, have to check things to make sure it was done right, because those people are trying to be in perfect control of themselves, in perfect control of their behavior. And then you have on the other side, people who need to see themselves as perfect, what they call a narcissistic personality disorder. You might have read a little bit about that, it's been in the papers. But that's a person, we see a person with grandiosity, where a person looks like he thinks very highly of himself. You see that sometimes in kids, like they walk around looking as if they think they know better than everybody else. Their need to feel that is because underneath, obviously, they feel very low about themselves, and this is the only way they can fix that is by feeling they know better. Since it's all phony, therefore it usually alternates. You can see this in teenagers where you can see on them more often. Like at one minute they're walking around claiming they know everything, and you know everything you've learned in all your years of experience is worth nothing. And you know 20 minutes later they're crying like a baby that you know they're failures and they'll never get anywhere, and etc. etc. Those things come together. Now the question is, why does this happen? This is the main point I want to get to because I think this is something that's preventable. As I said, in order for a person to feel so driven that they have to be perfect, they obviously feel very imperfect. They feel flawed. They feel that they're very flawed. They feel a deep sense of shame that can only be compensated for by trying to do things perfectly. And I think the underlying cause, people have asked me, you know, every once in a while I get a call and, you know, somebody wants me to see a kid, a teenager often, and I say, I'm sorry, I'm very busy. I don't have an opening right now. I'll give you a name of somebody else. I give him another name, so I call them. He's busy. Okay, he doesn't have no opening. I give him another name. You know, then I by my fifth name, I see where we're heading. You know, he's already called. I'm the last guy in the line. It's not great for my ego, but I'll have to assume they didn't know. You know, I come from a different part of town. But in any case, and you know, now they're angry at me. You're like, so what am I supposed to do? I'm really sorry. I can't see two people at the same time. So I've been asked by people, like, you know, well, what's going on? Like, why is this happening? Because life supposedly has gotten better, you know? Like, we live in such a wonderful time. Why are there so many kids who are unhappy? And I think the reason is, to boil it down to its essence, is I think that it's increasingly difficult for kids to feel that they satisfy their parents. You know, I always think about, my wife had a grandmother. She lived to her 90s. So I know pretty well. And whenever she met anybody from the family, or anybody she was interested in, she asked three questions. And if you answered yes on these three questions, and she was happy, this is it. She asked like this. You're making a living? She didn't ask if you're making a living, you know, a great living. She didn't ask if, you know, if you have six cars. You're making a living. Have a job. You have a job? That's great. You had lunch? You ate lunch? Then it's wonderful. You obviously had what to eat. And, you know, you're religious. She didn't ask how religious. She didn't ask about the size of the yarmulke, its color, you know, with the jacket, with the hat. She didn't ask any of those questions. If you were, you know, keep Shabbos, you had lunch, and you have a job. Like, what else can you ask for? And she would shine from ear to ear, you know, and couldn't be better. Who today would be satisfied with that? You know, it would be an embarrassment. Right. And I think that the same thing is true of children. You know, when we deal with our children, it's like we have these expectations. Like, which parent today would be satisfied if their child got average grades in school? It would be a shanda. I mean, you know, an embarrassment. What would you tell the neighbors? You know, I recently heard a tape from an incredible principal of Yeshiva High School. He was somebody, unfortunately, died at too young of an age. But he was somebody really incredible. But one point, he was speaking to other educators, I think it was at Torah Masorah Convention, and the reason why he did so fantastic, I think he had such an incredible influence, is because he looked at every kid positively. No matter how many problems he has, he just had such a positive outlook. So he's telling these other educators, he says, like, why are you getting upset at these kids? In today's America, the mere fact that the kid is in yeshiva, I mean, you know, for that alone, he deserves a tremendous amount of respect. And that was really his baseline. Although he was a very demanding person and had high standards, but his baseline is, I got to respect you just for the fact that you're here. You know, and I think that if a person develops that within themselves, we help children develop that themselves, a reasonable expectation for themselves, and some self-acceptance, that whatever they grow on top of that is dessert. But it's not that it doesn't become the minimal level. It's very nice if a kid does well in school and takes school seriously and gets good grades, but shouldn't have to feel it's 95 or you know, or otherwise it's a disaster. One of the main problems, I think, that brings to the kids feeling that they can't satisfy their parents is because I think we've become overly critical. I would say if parents would stop being critical, my colleagues and myself would all be unemployed, at least the vast majority of us. When kids sometimes tell me in sessions, you know, what they're criticized for and at what cost, you know, it's what happens is even when things get bad and there's a lot of conflict and tension, like nothing changes. You know, the parent will still be measuring, this is a true story, you know, measuring the kid's yarmulke with a ruler to make sure it's not a centimeter smaller than whatever it was supposed to be. You know, this is when the kid is barely keeping Shabbos. You know, there's a total loss of perspective. One kid, incredible but true story, the kid was living at home for 3 years, has not said a word to anybody in his family, spending most of the time in his room. Comes out at night when everybody's sleeping, eats. The Shabbos will come to the table for a short period of time. Father calls me up in a panic one day. Says, you know, this is really terrible. You know, he doesn't stay to the end of the meal. He goes up to his room. Now, and this guy's not a crazy person I'm talking about. He's a, you know, relatively, you know, everyday person, father. So I'm thinking to myself that the father's upset about how depressed the kid is, that he can, you know, can't tolerate being around everybody else for more than 20 minutes. I say to him, yes, look, Mr. So-and-so, I realize it's upsetting to you, you know, but he is severely depressed, you know, we're working on it. So, by the way, he's in college now, miraculously. But he still hasn't spoken to them since, you know, yet, but he's in college. The father says, I still tell you, like, he's very depressed. I understand your concern. He says, you don't understand. He leaves the table before benching. He's the mezumen. Right? He's the third one to bench with. Like, how can he leave the table? I would drop the phone. I said, you know, is this really what you're concerned about? Like, I'm concerned about the kid being suicidal. You're concerned because he leaves the table? Like, incredible. Now, so one point is, you know, I think we have to cut back on criticism. I think if we, most of us, and I speak for myself too, you know, if we measured, counted the times we criticize and compared to the times we compliment, I think we'd be embarrassed with the results. I've made an experiment. Once in a while I ask a kid, when was the last time one of your parents complimented you? You know, most time kids have no clue. I have no problem in asking the last time they were criticized. It's usually, it comes pretty easy. But when I ask the kid, just try to think about it. I give them some time to think. Try to remember the last time you were complimented. No. Lucky, maybe a month ago, you know. You know. Now, we may think that the kid knows. Of course, we brag to our neighbors about how the kid does. That drives kids crazy. So we don't say anything to them. We don't have an idea of the message we're giving to the kid. There was a guy in Israel who has a yeshiva for kids who ran away from home. He told me he once did an experiment. He went to a very religious neighborhood, and he went into the nursery, and he asked the kids, the boys there, he said, listen, boys, tell me, what is it that your father wants from you? Like, what's like the important thing that your father wants for you, from you? One kid says, not to put my foot on the couch. Not to put my foot on the couch? How about learning Torah? Yeah, that's also important, but the main thing is not to put my foot on the couch. He goes, ask the other kid, you know, what's the most important thing that you know, your father wants from you? Put my toys away. How about to keep the mitzvahs? Well, yeah, he talks about that too sometimes, but the main thing is to put my toys away. Okay, another problem is the idea of accepting limitations, right? Part of the problem of being a perfectionist is that they do not accept any environmental or personal limitations. I once worked with a girl who moved to America from Israel. and she was a great student there, always got in the high 90s, and she didn't speak a word of English. I think she came here at the age of 8. So, of course, she's not doing very well in school, and she is miserable. Miserable, depressed, she's failing, what's going on? I said, what's going on? You understand the words the teacher is saying? What's going on? It's like, obviously what's going on. And she didn't accept that. That wasn't an excuse. Now, there are some limitations that are obvious to us, objective limitations. Like most adults would understand, not understand, knowing the language is a pretty reasonable limitation. We understand if we think the kid doesn't have a high IQ, so we can understand there's a limit to how well they can do. But there are other limitations that are just as meaningful and probably even more meaningful that we don't pay any attention to. You know, if a kid is miserable, if we usually are very high functioning, but if we have some tremendous worry on our head, it doesn't affect all of us. Doesn't our level of achievement drop? Right? Now, some people feel like that all the time. There's some kids who are extremely unhappy, very frustrated, depressed. So, of course, they're not going to function very high, at a very high level. But they don't accept that as a limitation. We never taught them that how you feel affects how you function. Something so elementary, we just ignore it. Kids are usually told, what's a famous saying that parents tell kids or teachers? If you'd only try harder, you'd do better. If you'd only want to, you'd succeed. That is not always true. As I told one parent who had told this to their kid, and he happened to be overweight and smoked, I said, I imagine if you only wanted to, you could stop smoking and lose 40 pounds. He didn't appreciate it. Right? It isn't true that whatever you want, you can do. There are sometimes things that we can't do. The supposed off-quoted chazal of Ein lecha davar ayma lifnei haratzon, loosely translated, when there's a will, there's a way, actually doesn't exist. There is no such chazal. I did extensive research. I did a computer search. I spoke to three of the foremost gedolim in America, in Israel, when I was visiting there, and that chazal does not exist. There is no such chazal. Contrary, it's quoted all over the place. It doesn't exist. I'm sorry? I'll tell you what. The actual original source, I tracked down the source. The source of... I'm sorry? Probably. They need to make a poster or something for... Exactly. They're putting a poster there. No, probably. The source is a Zohar, which says that what you achieve is indicative of what your will was. So somebody assumed, and the flip side must be true also. But it's absurd. It isn't. It's certainly true. What you do achieve, it probably indicates what was important to you. But that does not automatically mean what's important to you, you can achieve. The simple proof is, any one of us could think of something we wanted very much to achieve and we didn't. Of course, the usual answer to that is that obviously you didn't really want it enough. When there's a will, there's a way, so if there's no way, there probably wasn't enough of a will. But that's an absurd reasoning. And logic, in the study of logic, they call that a tautology. Now you say, I can prove to you that all cars are white. You say, well, how's that possible? I just saw a car go by, it's blue. So it's obviously not a car because all cars are white. I mean, you can say anything that way. Yeah. So it's an absurd thing to tell a child because it ignores a lot of limitations. Will is only one part. Obviously, if you're not interested in something, you're probably not going to do very well. So will is important, intelligence is important, peace of mind is important. And I tell you, if I had to choose one thing for a kid to have to do well in school, I'd give him peace of mind above anything else. Because there's more kids who are doing poorly in school for lack of peace of mind than because of poor intelligence. Now another cause for perfectionism is the fact that we put a tremendous amount of emphasis, unfortunately, I think all of us to some degree or another, on external things instead of internal things, making an impression. A example that I'll never forget, this happened a few years ago. I was working with a teenager who was in a terrible, his relationship with his parents was really in an all-time low. And it come to the point that he hadn't spoken to his mother in 3 months. In fact, it was this time of the year. You'll hear the reason why how I remember this time of the year. So he hadn't spoken to his mother in 3 months. And he comes in to the session and tells me, oh man, am I in trouble? My father is so mad at me. And I'm thinking, let's see, what did he do? Did he steal a car? Did he, break into the bank? I said, my God, what happened? He says, I didn't send my mother a Mother's Day card. I go, Mother's Day, Scott, you haven't spoken to her in 3 months. He says, yeah, that's what I told my father. But he said, that doesn't matter. It's Mother's Day. You have to send your mother a mother. She'll be so upset. She'll be so hurt. All right? So, you know, it's form over substance. So the child then feels that, you know, unhappiness is a substance, it's not form. You know, getting a 95 is form. You know, that's impressive. You know, you get a 98, everybody thinks how wonderful you are. The fact that you're happy, like, who cares? Like, nobody knows, nobody cares. Right? So if we don't value things that are internal, then, you know, it's not surprising that the child puts all their emphasis on external things. It was always amazing, you know, when the kid begins to act out, in cases where that's the problem, so the kid will wear certain clothes that the parents don't approve of, and the kid will say, you know, the parents say, you can't wear that, it's not acceptable, and the kids say, well, all the kids are wearing it. Well, I don't care what all the kids are doing. You know, what's the famous line? You know, if some other kid jumps off the roof, would you jump off the roof, you know? And what the kid tells me is, like, you know, his whole life is being told he has to do things because that's what everybody else does. You know, he's not allowed to dress like that because people don't dress like that. He's not allowed to do this because all of a sudden what everybody does is somehow not important anymore. If we make it if we show the child that his feelings are very important, we save ourselves a tremendous amount of aggravation down the road. If this is a typical thing that happens, I met this kid like once. We talked one time. We came for whatever it is we spoke about. I bring him out to the waiting room. His mother's waiting outside. And she says, "Oh, by the way, if I have a minute to speak to you, do you think I should send him to camp in Israel this summer?" I have no idea. We didn't discuss it. You know, you didn't tell me this was an issue. If you want, next time, you know, when he comes, we'll talk about it. No. But, you know, you're the professional. You spoke to him. You met him. Do you think it's a good thing for him? Like there's some objective barometer that has nothing to do with... I said, don't you think it makes a difference if he would hate the idea of going or if he would love to go? I mean, wouldn't that make some difference in the decision-making process? This happens very frequently. They ask me things that I never discussed with a kid. Like, how am I supposed to know? How can I have an independent opinion, independent of the child's feelings about it? You know? Should he go to this camp or that camp? I don't know. How does he feel about it? You can have two camps or two schools. Now, one school could be, school A could be better than school B. But if all his friends are going to school B and he's dying to go to school B and would be outraged if he went to school A, then school A is probably not a good choice. The objective criteria that school A is considered a better school, it may not be relevant. And we ignore that. We ignore, in making the decision, we ignore the child's feelings. And then, you know, of course, he doesn't have respect for his own feelings. In fact, this is not on the topic, but just an interesting point. I work a lot also with people who are having a hard time finding shidduch and getting married, you know, and I found one very crucial factor is because they're so disattached from their feelings. There are certain types of decisions that require that the way you decide is really your feelings. You go look for a house, you can see 5 houses that meet your criteria. You know, how do you choose which one of the 5? Now, some can't choose and never buy a house. Right? The way you choose is a feeling. You walk into a certain house and it has a feeling. You know, oh, this is what this is it. You know, is there some objective reason? No, you know, the other houses are just as good. So part of a decision, you know, getting married is part of it based on a feeling. But if people are so detached from their feelings, when I ask them how they feel about the girl they went out with, well, he told me this, and I'm asking what people told you. I'm asking how you feel. The language doesn't exist. They don't know what to tell me. You know, they tell me objective things. Well, you know, she finished college. I'm not asking. I'm asking, how do you feel about the girl? They don't understand what the question is relating to. But we have to teach them that. We have to make it clear to them that, to us, how they feel is very important. See, when a kid comes home from, if a kid gets in trouble in school or anywhere else, or he did something wrong or something that's, you know, not the usual thing they do, so the question is to the child, like, what does this represent? You know, what does this mean? Another day, a mother calls me. I've seen her son twice. He's been acting out. And so he comes, he stayed out all night, he didn't come home. I think he was 15 or 16. The mother's outraged. And she doesn't, you know, I say to her, this is indicative of something very wrong. That's the question here. You know, well, don't I have to crack down? You crack down when things are going reasonably smoothly and the kids, you know, broke a rule. You want to crack down, it makes sense. You know, you want to let them know that there's rule. But when all hell's breaking loose, like, what exactly you gain? There's an incredible Chazanish, just incidentally, this recent cipher came out about him, that there was a story, there was a kid who became a Mechal Shabbos. So then he had the nerve, this is in the Chazanish's time, right? I'm impressed that he had the nerve to do this. He asked his father to buy him a car. The father said, all right, I'll buy you the car if you agree not to drive it on Shabbos. The kid refused. So that's caused further tension between them. And the Chazanish heard about it, and he sent a message to the father, it's worth, you should buy him the car without any conditions. Because then you'll have more influence. In other words, if you understand that what's going on emotionally within the child is the most important thing as far as his future success. So if a child is going around getting great grades, it throws us off. See, when a child rebels, it's obvious that something's wrong. When he's doing great, so it's not obvious that there's any problem. This is the worst thing when the kid is doing great and all of a sudden has a nervous breakdown or develops physical symptoms or just stops functioning. The thing that always hits me, and I really feel bad for the parents. They come in and they go, I can't believe this. It's like, this is impossible. See, when a kid goes the other direction, usually it's a process, right? You know, usually the kid starts doing poorly in school, he starts breaking rules, and it's like nobody's shocked. But here, usually it's like a dam breaking. You know, we don't see what's going on. It's like a little crack in the dam, we don't notice, and all of a sudden the dam goes. And he said, I don't believe it. This is the way I usually hear it. He was the best kid in the class, and this is always one. He was the perfect child, which it should have been the giveaway. My mother said to me, says, I'm telling you, I'm not exaggerating. From the day he was born until today, he was never angry. Okay? I should tell you something. You know, if a kid's getting 98s all the time, unless he's a super genius, I'd be very worried. There's something wrong. It's become too important to him. He's working too hard to impress us. And what's not happening is he's not impressing himself. Because it's all true. Because we've never made it important to him that he should impress himself. One last story that I will say some questions. There was recently, a father came to me. I had seen the father 2 years ago. He had come to me, his son was thrown out of yeshiva because he tried to burn the yeshiva down. So the father, you know, and it was the whole situation there was a tremendous amount of conflict and tension, and the whole relationship had broken down. And after I met the kid twice, I saw what was going on. I sat down with the father. I said, listen, he seemed like a very reasonable, he seemed very eager to do whatever he can. He was very open. You know, he didn't hide anything. He said, you know, he was aware of the things that the mistakes he had made. And I said, look, I could either take a long time to do it without your help, or it can go a lot quicker if you change things. If you show, this is the way I put it to him. If you show your son that how he feels is more important to you than how he behaves, then I promise you he'll turn around very quickly. And he did it, amazingly enough. Usually it doesn't work, but he did. He really did an incredible, struggled with himself, and he really turned it completely around. And the relationship improved dramatically. Unfortunately, everybody was so impressed how well it went, I said, well, the kid still needs a lot of therapy. But they didn't listen, and he went to Israel. He ended up by a very, very good yeshiva. Yeshiva knows how to deal with his kid. And the kid, I didn't hear anything. Father shows up, asks to meet with me. He tells me the kid for 2 years was doing incredibly wonderfully. Incredibly, he was a great student, and he was learning, and he was davening, he was doing everything. Father told me he had visited a few times. He had such nachas, you can't imagine. What happened? He comes back. I didn't think he came to give me all this good news, you know. He tells me, he comes back, he said, within 4 weeks, the kid sleeping till 12 o'clock, hanging around with the terrible friends he used to hang around with. What's even worse, he developed a symptom. He was convinced that he has incredible bad breath, that you can't stay in a room with him, and that everybody notices it. The father took him to a doctor. The father didn't notice anything. He thought, already took him to a doctor. The doctor said, there's absolutely nothing wrong, you know, in his head. The father understood it was a reflection of the child's self-image, that he feels he's defective and that everybody notices it. But he says to me, and he was devastated, the father says, how is this possible? For 2 years, he was doing great. Like, how does this happen in 4 weeks? I said to the father, listen, one of the reasons I told you he needs therapy is because he did not have, his whole life was, he was raised to impress other people. Was to make his father happy, and his father's purpose in life was to make his father happy. The father explained to me, I once asked the father, because he seemed like a real reasonable guy, and he was doing unreasonable things. I told him once, let me ask you straight, I mean, you know, why are you doing this? It's absurd, like, you know, and I see you're a reasonable person. He said, you don't understand, I have to answer to my father. I said, I'm your son's chayvin, I don't think it's a good idea. Stand up to your father and take care of your kid, which he did. But what trouble is, by this time, the kid was not able to to internalize anything good about himself. He did not have channels. His look was always toward everybody, seeing himself through the reflection of other people. He did not have any way of internalizing good feelings. It didn't exist. So he went to Israel, did great for 2 years, and impressed everybody that he's really a good boy. Unfortunately, he impressed everybody except himself. So long as he had this Rosh Hashiva, who was a wonderful person, you know, so he was feeding off the Rosh Hashiva. He was getting, he was plugged in there, getting the juice from there. It's like a plug-in, you know, rechargeable flashlight. And once you get unplugged, it doesn't last forever. 4 weeks, and poof, there goes the battery. And now you have to, you know, get recharged. But he's not able to internalize it, because this was never stressed in his life. In his life, it was never stressed that his job is to make himself happy. It always annoys me by bar mitzvahs, you know, what are we always saying? You should bring a lot of nachas to your parents. But Simcha Wasserman Zatzal used to say, children are not nachas machines. They weren't created in this world to bring nachas to us. Maybe they're created to bring nachas to themselves or to their Bnei Shalom, but not to the parents. Parents get incidental nachas. If the child is happy and feels themselves that they are successful, hopefully we'll have enough sense to have nachas. But that's not their purpose. And by telling them to that way, they end up spending so much energy trying to impress everybody, they're left feeling empty, and therefore they're not surprisingly depressed. Question? Yes. First of all, by talking about it. Oh, the question was, like, how do we raise children in order that where they will be in touch with their feelings and to relate to their feelings? A, by us taking it seriously. In other words, you know, a child says, I'd say, I'm not doing homework. I can't stand I'm not doing homework. You know, I imagine most of us, what we would do, it'd be crazy, I'm not doing homework. You have to be doing homework. You'll fail, and then you fail, then you won't get anywhere in life, and then when you get older, you won't get a job, and then nobody will want to marry you, and you know, right? Instead of saying, gee, what's the matter? Nothing bad. I just can't stand it. I don't want to do any homework. No, I really want to know. I'm not upset at you. I just want to know what, you know, something happened. You usually do your homework. There must be some reason. It may take a little coaxing, you know, until you get him to say what's really bothering him. But at least even if he doesn't answer you, just showing that you're not so much concerned about the homework, but you're rather more concerned about why he doesn't want to do it. Not because of the homework per se, because there's obviously something wrong. Just like if somebody gets a high fever, the doctor's concerned not so much about the fever, but like what's causing it, an infection or something is wrong. If we relate to it that way, then we're more likely to find out. Yes? No, I actually asked the parents. You know, what I did was I followed up with one of the kids, and I asked this parent, it happened not too long ago, let me just bring back to memory. I asked the parents, a kid had gotten in trouble, whatever, but I asked the parents, I said, they seemed very reasonable and open, and they were, you know, weren't being defensive, so yeah, I'd like to get those opportunities to ask these questions, because I know they'll tell me. So the father said, look, I'll tell you the truth. He was the oldest boy, the oldest kid in the family, a boy. He said, I can see that I don't have the same relationship with him as I have with other kids. Like, I don't have an open conversation with him. He says, and I know why. He was my oldest. I had these tremendous high expectations. He's like a very intellectual, the father. And nothing he did, you know, was really ever good enough. And he says, well, of course he doesn't remember when I compliment him, because I don't think it ever happened. He was honest. And if you think about it, because our assumption is whatever somebody does right, I think we do with ourselves too. I mean, I don't think it's only with children. We don't compliment ourselves either, because whatever we do right, we assume that's expected. So why should I get complimented? Whenever I suggest to people, children or adults, you know, who may be depressed or whatever, I say, you know, they did something good, I say, wow, you know, that's good, you know. They look at me like I'm crazy. Like, where'd that come from? I did something. I'm supposed to do that. Like, why should I be happy? It's interesting. Somebody brought it up in the other group. I'm working with an anorexic girl actually right now. And of course, you know, with anorexics, it's the same thing. She was, you know, made self-conscious about external things. And talking about the anorexia reminds me of another case also about food and weight, which I think also brings out this point. And has a, there was this fellow that came who was recently married. He was married for about a year and a half or something. He has this terrible problem. He can't look at his wife. That's the problem. He's embarrassed to tell me. It's her looks. And he says, I know it's crazy because everybody tells me she's beautiful, and, you know, I eventually saw her. There was absolutely nothing wrong with her looks. Now, he himself was not much to look at. He was about 40, 50 pounds overweight. Definitely, she beat him by miles, you know. And she was a very reasonable person. She said, you know, she knows he's overweight. It doesn't bother her too much. You know, she can live with it. He's a nice guy. You know, a lot of fine questions. The way he got this and she got some, she doesn't know. But, you know, otherwise, he's a fine, you know, he's nice. She likes him. He had a lot of nice, fine qualities. He was very giving and very caring. But this thing, like, was an obsession. So I realized there's something not normal here, right? In clinical terms. So, you know, it was strange. It wasn't just abnormal. It was, like, strange. Like, where did this come from? So I figured, I had a hunch. I said to him, let me ask you, you know, how long is it that you're overweight? He says, well, since I'm a little kid. I said, well, how'd your parents deal with it? That opened up like, my mother. My mother, you have no idea what she's been driving me crazy since far back as I can remember. Screaming, yelling, pushing, this, restricting. To the point that the day before he got married, for years his mother told him nobody ever want to marry him. Finally, somebody did want to marry him. No, so his mother told him that this is his mother's words of wisdom the day before he got married. She won't stay more than a month because of his weight. So look at the paradox, what happened here. So he married a beautiful girl, and he can, some minor, I don't know, some, you know, imperfection that you need a microscope to see, like he can't live with. And she, right, and she, who's supposedly supposed to want to leave him, you know, was not bothered at all by his looks. Right? In other words, so taking something external and making it so important just distorts. That happens a lot when people with shidduchim. I have a lot of problems with it. I deal a lot with people who are having a hard time with shidduchim. So these same two reasons. One reason is because they're not in touch with their feelings. And to get married, you need feelings. It's one of the most important things you need to get married with. Right? Because otherwise, in fact, there's a Chazainish that says that, you know, the Gemara, the Chazal says, there's a bas kol that comes out and says, this person for that person. For years it bothered me, what's the purpose of a bas kol that nobody hears? Like, what was its function? I asked quite a few people. Some very, not, you know, learned people. Like, what does it mean? There's a bas kol, whoopee-doopee, you know? I could also tell you, you know, there is a lottery card that's the winner. You know, what good does that do to you? I don't know which one it is. Right? So there's somebody out there for you, but you have no clue. So what is the bas kol? So the Chazal says, the bas kol is your feeling. If you go out with a girl who's appropriate to you and you have feelings for her, that is the bas kol. Now, in order to hear it, you have to be in touch with your feelings, otherwise you can't hear it. You also have to respect it. It has to be meaningful to you, which a lot of people it isn't.
So all in all, if we respect a child's feelings and help the child take his or her feelings seriously, it not only helps them get through school and get through a happy childhood, it also prepares them for making the choices in later life, starting from the choices they make, you know, they need to make in order to get married. Thank you very much.